History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And you've probably heard me say they don't have to go untold, as long as we're willing to take that initiative to ask a few questions, and then, this is important, employ the patience to listen as memories from long ago take on new life in the here and now. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we find ourselves inspired by where they've been, what they've endured, and sometimes even what they're up to now. World War II has been the focal point just about every week for the last 15 years this program has been on the radio, and we'll hear a few memories from that World War II era today. But the veteran we're going to have the privilege of visiting with served a few years after World War II, and he could tell you the significance of this weekend and specifically June 25th. It was June 25th, 1950, that the Korean War began. And over the next 37 months, with the eyes of the world on the 38th parallel, more than a dozen nations were involved in a conflict that claimed millions of lives, including more than 54,000 American lives. The names of more than 36,000 Americans killed in action are currently in the process of being added to the Korean War Veterans Memorial on the National Mall in Washington, D.C., where more than 7,000 names of fallen South Korean veterans will be etched in granite as well. There are still, all these years later, more than 7,000 Americans listed as missing in action from that war that ended nearly 70 years ago. And perhaps you've heard it called the Forgotten War. Over the years on Hometown Heroes, we've heard from plenty of World War II vets who also went on to serve in Korea. We've heard from a few men who ended up as prisoners of war in Korea. But the nearly 7 million American men and women who served in our armed forces during the Korean War era contributed in so many different ways. And like our World War II veterans, many of those vets from the Korean War period continue to find ways to serve today. We get to meet one of them in 90-year-old Roland Dorfer of Apopka, Florida. If you're a regular listener to Hometown Heroes, maybe that name, Apopka, a suburb of Orlando, rings a bell, because over recent months we've heard from a few different vets who were involved with the veterans of foreign wars there. Those veterans have spanned generations from World War II to Vietnam and even the war in Afghanistan. They've represented multiple ethnic backgrounds, and we've met male and female veterans who work together there at their VFW posts the way so many veterans do in so many communities around the country. If you were to visit VFW Post 10147 in Apopka, you would see quite a bit of the fruit of Roland Dorfer's labor. From the updated and spruced up museum at the post to the classy and clean podium that speakers stand behind, this 90-year-old Navy veteran from the Korean War has had a hand in all of it with help from his wife, Judy. But there's a lot that happened in your life before you ever met Judy, so let's go all the way back to the beginning, Roland.
Well, I was born in Goodland, Kansas, a farming community in northwest Kansas close to the Colorado line. But most of my life, early life, was spent in Colorado, in the mountain country around Cripple Creek, Colorado. And in my first 3 years, we lived on a gold mine when my dad was a resident caretaker of the place, and he also worked the mine. So I spent 3 years of my life after we left. Well, before that, when my mom and dad first got married, they couldn't afford, you know, whatever it took to live on. So we lived in a sod house on the ranch of my great uncle. Well, actually, it was my great grandfather's and then my great uncle when he took over. So we spent a year in a sod house, and I don't remember any of it, but it was hell. In the plains of eastern Colorado, where the snow went sideways and the wind and the tumbleweeds, and then there was the great grasshopper invasion of the 1933 that we went through. I don't remember any of that, but my mom and dad sure do, and my grandfather, his father, took us out, and the floor of the sod house, well, it was dirt. but my grandfather had a sod house, which was a wooden floor, and it was the largest in the area. And he had dances in his house, and it was the biggest one, and it had a wood floor. So, and he played the violin and the xylophone. No, anyway, it was another stringed instrument. I can't remember.
And for people listening, a lot of people have never heard the term sod house before, and some of them, they're trying to spell it. They're saying S-A-W-E-D. You're saying, no, S-O-D.
S-O-D, mud and straw was the sod house. Just made it up in bricks and stacked it up and lasted for a while. So anyway, that was it, and it had one door and a window on each side, and it was no bigger than a modern bedroom for the three of us. So anyway, we moved to Colorado. My dad got a job in the Isabella Gold Mine. We lived on that mine site at 11,000 feet up the side of Bull Mountain. It was me, my grandfather, my mother and dad, and two old prospectors, and, you know, and my dog Jimmy. That was my family collection for 2 years at least.
Well, and I know a lot of kids who grow up dreaming of finding a gold nugget or even a little gold dust somewhere or another. I have to imagine if you're growing up around a gold mine, maybe you have a little different perspective on all that. What excited you about that existence?
I wasn't even aware of why we were there. You know, you got to remember, I was 2 years old or two and a half, almost 3 years old when we moved there. I just had the free rein to go where I wanted to. My mother always warned me, watch out for those holes in the ground, because these guys out here dig those holes looking for gold, and they don't cover them up or they get done. So that was always my warning there. And my grandfather never did strike that gold vein that he knew was there. The other two guys, they would go through the rock pile, the discharge pile, pick out rock, chip out what was not profitable for the big company to mine. They made a fair living on just those scraps. But anyway, and then we moved to Cripple Creek when I got to be school age. That was a gold mining town that was dying at the time. Of course, now it's a gambling mecca, but at that time it wasn't. So spent the rest of my life till I was 9 there. And when my dad decided to go look for a job and never came back, my mom and I and my pregnant mother moved to Goodland to live with my grandparents. So that's where we spent the next 10 years.
You say that very matter-of-factly, but if I imagine being that 9-year-old kid, when that happens, I mean, that has to be painful, frustrating, alarming, scary. I mean, how would you describe the impact that had on your outlook?
I have to tell you, it didn't bother me a bit. The thing is that when we moved to my grandparents' house, they had 10 kids over their lifetime of years. The last daughter had moved out. There were four boys there and four uncles, and the youngest uncle was younger than me. So we became like brothers, and we'd played before when we came to Goodland to visit. So, quite frankly, I didn't miss my dad. We did our thing, and, you know, we weren't discipline problems. We just played, went out and foraged around town. We lived a block from the roundhouse of the Rock Island Railroad, so we went down there to watch them switch engines, you know. It was not a bad childhood, but I really didn't. I've never missed my dad, but I have questioned in my mind when I got older at times why. And when I was a senior, for some reason, whatever I was thinking, if I get married, I will never leave my wife. And so that was the one remnant that stuck with me. Of course, 24 years later, I didn't worry about it because she left me. So, you know, that hurt. That was one of the biggest hurtful events of my life, even though I should have seen it coming.
And I'm thinking, too, if you're 90 now, I'm sure you have a memory of those World War II years and how things changed, and maybe about December 7th, 1941. I'm fascinated to hear how different people found out what happened, how the news got to them, and how it struck them. Do you have a memory of that day?
I don't have a specific memory, but I knew I was aware of it because the grandfather that I lived with always had the news on. And you didn't raise Cain, you didn't make any noise when the news was on. He had his floor Crosley radio nearby, and if you're going to play, you go outside. But anyway, I had an uncle, the oldest of my four uncles, was drafted, and he went into the service and served in the 1st Infantry Division, the Big Red One in Germany. But even apart from that, I kept close track of that war. I had maps on the wall. I knew where all of the fighting fronts were. I knew the capitals and the major cities of every country in Europe and the Far East. It was something that fascinated me. And, of course, when I get older, I'm going to be a fighter pilot. Well, but I would never have made that anyway. But by the time I was old enough, the war was over. But that was my only thinking about what I would do if I was part of it, which had nothing to do with when I enlisted in the Navy upon graduation. But I was an avid student of World War II.
And, you know, today, if we want to know what's happening around the world, we pull out a little smartphone or we get on the computer and we can find just about anything. But for you, as you were saying that you had maps and you're keeping track, how would you get different pieces of information? What was it that informed you?
Well, at that time, which is most people aren't aware of, Saturday night when we went to the movie, when the movie was over, they had a newsreel. And they're black and white, and they showed all the events of the week, the live films of the battles that went on. Of course, they never showed any American losses, but it was that was the main source. And Bill and I, my near brother, would go home and reenact things, you know, and we would be very active based on what we saw on the newsreel. But that was the main source, that and the radio. But I wasn't content to sit and listen to the radio and be quiet like my grandfather wanted, so I got it mainly from the newspaper. I delivered the Omaha World Herald around town, and Denver Post was available, so I got my news through the print and the radio and the Saturday night newsreels.
And did life change for your family much during those war years because of what was necessary on the home front with the rationing and all that, or other considerations?
More than I realized at the time. To me, it was very common to have very little to eat. I mean, we didn't starve, but we were meat and potatoes. Grandpa bought potatoes by the 100 pounds, put them under the house, and had our chicken live. I remember her cutting the heads off and watching that hen flop around the yard spewing blood everywhere. That was one of my memories for that. Of course, we had to pluck it. Then that was even more distasteful. So, the rationing. I mean, you couldn't buy much of anything. You couldn't buy tires. You couldn't buy gas. You couldn't buy sugar. There were a lot of things that you couldn't buy without a coupon. When those coupons ran out, tough, you couldn't get it. But we did have a victory garden. Under the clothesline in the backyard, Grandma planted vegetables. So we had our supply of vegetables. We had some kind of meat on the weekend, either chicken or hamburger. So, like I said, we didn't starve. We didn't have a varied menu, but that was all right. I didn't know any different. There were so many foods I haven't heard of until I got out and married this woman, Judy. She introduced me to a number of different foods I never heard of.
And do you remember in those boyhood years, or teenage years, you said fighter pilot? Maybe, was that a real ambition of yours? Was that something you said, hey, this is what I'm going to go accomplish?
It was more a flicker in the pan, you know. It just looked appealing to me. I didn't want to, there were a lot of things. I didn't want to carry a rifle across the fighting ground, the infantry, you know. But as it turns out, I didn't have to do any of that. But my reason for joining the Navy was something entirely different when I graduated.
Well, I have to follow up and ask what that was, if it was entirely different. What was your reason for enlisting in the Navy at 18?
Well, during high school, I was a self-appointed school photographer. In my sophomore year, I convinced my mother to buy me a speed graphic camera. I don't know if you were aware of those, a big camera with a big flash bulb on it. Saw that in Montgomery Ward, and it was $200. And I said, Mama, that's what I want. She worked it out, but I think she had some help with her employer. The attorney she worked for in Goodland, I think he helped out on that. That gave me an opening to go out and take pictures. I could get up and leave the classroom whenever I wanted to, although that really wasn't quite what the teachers had in mind, to go and take pictures of what was going on. So that led to my desire to be a photojournalist. And then I had a good friend, Floyd Harding. He's still around like me. He's in Texas, Arlington, Texas. He came to study hall a few times, and he'd bring these colorful brochures about the military, about the Navy. And he'd go through and he'd keep telling me, you know, but we could go see the world, you know, and he kept on me about that. And then when I found out through a little investigation that you could pick your trade, I said, well, if I can become a Navy photographer, I'll do it. And when we went down to talk to the recruiter, he said, absolutely, you can do that. So fine, we enlisted. Went to boot camp together in San Diego. But a week after we enlisted, North Korea invaded South Korea. So that the war started. That would mean all bets were off. You know, if they needed me somewhere else, the heck with the school, they'll send me. And a week before boot camp was out, I got orders to report to the USS Philippine Sea, which was a small attack carrier. But I hadn't gotten out of boot camp yet. So those orders were canceled. A week later, I got them, Memphis, Tennessee, then Pensacola, Florida for my photographer's training. And then when I got out of there, they sent me to Norfolk in Virginia, and I was assigned to an amphibious command flagship. And I spent the rest of my years on an admiral staff. Sailed gracefully around the Caribbean and the Mediterranean, even up to the North Sea, you know. I went to Africa and Cuba and various places. I really felt guilty for a while after I got out. I did not wear anything which reflected me as a Korean veteran because I didn't feel like I had earned that. I didn't serve on the ground and be shot at and have to spend those bitter winters in that country. Anyway, for 40 years, I didn't wear one. Finally, in South Florida, I joined the VA Center Hospital, went out to there one day, and there was this shop that had the hats. And I got this brainstorm, said, you know, that people are calling the Korean War a forgotten war. I said, well, that's wrong. If I can wear a hat, it doesn't matter whether I was there or not. It tells people there was such a place. And when people see it, they congratulate me, and I accept it and thank them, and at least they acknowledge the fact that they read the hat. So I wear it all the time now. For the last 8 years, something like that, I've even got two of them now. So, but that was my story as far as the Navy. It was entirely self-centered. I was, through most of my teen years and my early adult life, I was pretty much a self-centered, somewhat smart-alecky kid, an adult. I just had this feeling, everything's going to be all right. Doesn't matter what I do, I'm going to be okay. And I never worried much about anything. And, of course, that worked against me at times. But now in the latter half of my life with my lovely wife now, I've grown a lot. Spiritually and in a state of acceptability and gratitude, all those things.
A candid and introspective conversation today with 90-year-old Roland Dorfer of Apopka, Florida, a Navy veteran of the Korean War. And a little bit of an aside here, I was reminded this week that Navy history, and really military history in general, is more accessible than we sometimes realize. Museum ships around our country are such a great resource. And as Top Gun Maverick continues to fill up theaters, you can see an F-14 from the original Top Gun on a ship where part of that was filmed, the USS Hornet Museum in Alameda, California, where the husband and wife docent team of Leroy and Cindy Savoy gave me a first-class tour this week. We'll be talking about the Hornet on a future episode. I had no idea how extensive an exhibit that aircraft carrier had on Japanese-American veterans in World War II, with memorabilia from several vets who you've met here on Hometown Heroes. So we'll get to that in the future, but as for today's guest, Roland Dorfer, there's one little detail we haven't touched on yet. It might become a problem at some point if you're on a Navy ship and you don't know how to swim, especially when you end up in the path of a hurricane. That story and more when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.